This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We were just having dinner and mentioned to Tony, said even if the book wasn't as good as it is, we still would be doing this. But what a great joy that the book is as great as it is, because it makes it all the more sincere, for one thing. Anthony Mara is the author of A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, winner of the inaugural John Leonard Prize for a first novel given by the National Book Critics Circle, also the Annisfield Wolf Book Award, and was also the inaugural recipient of the Carla Cohen Literary Award for fiction. In that book, Mara captivated readers with the story of resilient survivors during conflicts in Chechnya. In his new book of short stories, The Tsar of Love and Techno, Anthony Mara returns to Soviet Russia, telling the stories of people whose lives are affected by an obscure artist tasked with airbrushing people out of official photographs. We meet a former ballerina sentenced to a labor camp and her granddaughter, Galina, who improbably tries to follow her as a dancer. We meet small-time gangsters, soldiers, war widows, and con artists. The stories that make up the Tsar of Love and Techno are dramatic and sometimes poignant, often very funny, but the most amazing thing about them, I think, is the way the stories all relate to one another to complete a satisfying whole, a richly satisfying read, very much like reading a novel. In her rave review in the New York Times, Sarah Lyle writes, "He starts this miracle of a book by showing us how a system can erase the past, the truth, even its citizens. He ends up by demonstrating through his courageous, flawed, deeply human characters how individual people can restore the things that have been taken away." We are proud to host Anthony Mara and are overjoyed that his book is as good as it is. It's a real pleasure to get to introduce him again, and thanks for coming and help me introduce Anthony Mara.
Thank you so much, Mark, for that that beautiful and sincere introduction. it's truly a pleasure and honor to be here today. I feel like Politics and Prose is a second home, a little bit too much like home at times. I came here to shop for Christmas last year, and I ran into Mark and I said hello, and and Mark introduced me to a recently hired bookseller, a lovely young man. And Mark said, this is Anthony Mara. And the bookseller said, oh, nice to meet you. And then Mark said, he's Mary Sheehan's son. And the bookseller said, oh, my goodness. It's such a pleasure and honor, sir. And Mark turned to me and said, this is the only bookstore in America where you're best known as being Mary Sheehan's son. So it's a real thrill to be here. Thank you so much to Politics and Prose and to all of you for coming out on a Friday evening. I'm going to talk a little bit about how I came to write this book. I'll read for a very short time, and then I would be happy to entertain any and all questions. One question that I'll start off with is what is a nice boy of Italian and Irish stock doing writing about a place like Russia and Chechnya? And it is a very good question. It's a question that my relatives ask with some regularity. And it goes back to my time. My time wandering around the shelves here, I suppose, and falling in love with Russian literature, the great Russian novels. You know, reading a book like finishing a book like War and Peace or Anna Karenina or The Brothers Karamazov, whether or not you like it or not, just reaching the end is a milestone in your reading life. And I love those books because they seem to grapple with these sort of profound questions that that we all probably have, but probably don't admit to very often. You know, how do I lead a good life? What are what is my capacity for betrayal and forgiveness? How do I move through the world, you know, with a degree of dignity and grace? And it's almost like in American culture, I think sometimes we're suspicious of those questions because we doubt the very sincerity with which they're asked. And I started taking a couple of Russian literature classes in college, and I decided that I was gonna go study abroad in St. Petersburg. I went to school in Los Angeles, and the study abroad program had a 4-semester minimum requirement for studying Russian, and I had 0 semesters, but I wanted to be a fiction writer, and so I practiced my craft on my application. And I ended up in St. Petersburg in the middle of January. It was about -30 degrees. It was light for about 4 hours a day. And I lived with a family that spoke no English, and I spoke no Russian. And I lived with a mother and her 2 grown sons. And her sons were enthusiastic cigarette smokers, and the mother was very sweet, and she worried that my weak Western respiratory system couldn't handle the volume of her son's secondhand smoke, and so she stipulated that for reasons of health and safety, they could only smoke in the unventilated bathroom. And needless to say, they were not pleased with this. And in protest, they set up shop in the bathroom from about breakfast until bedtime. And over the course of my time there, more and more parts of the living room migrated into the bathroom until there was an armchair and a television and a stereo system. It looked like something between an out-of-date discotheque and the office of a pornographer who's fallen on hard times. Once I tried to use the bathroom, and their eyes sort of became death rays, and I backed up. And so I spent most of my time in St. Petersburg, one of the most beautiful cities on earth, in search of an unoccupied restroom. And on my daily or hourly, really, circuits of the neighborhood, I would often cross paths with a group of military cadets. And these were 16, 17-year-old kids at this military cadet academy down the road. And they'd march up and down the block in military formation. And as they would wear these beautiful sort of bright blue uniforms and peaked caps and just looked very smart. And as they were making their marching in information around the neighborhood, they sometimes would pass this metro station that had become a gathering point for other men in uniforms, in military uniforms. And these men were a few years older. Their uniforms weren't nearly so nice. Their arms and trouser legs were hemmed because they had lost limbs. And they were veterans of a conflict that these, 16 and 17-year-old cadets might one day join. And I remember just thinking that image sort of sticking with me, watching these 16 and 17-year-olds sort of marching lockstep past these homeless veterans who were at this metro station to panhandle. And it seeming like this moment where the past and the future were just sort of rubbing up against each other. And it just sort of lodged in the back of my mind, and I wanted to figure out what it was that separated these two groups of young men, besides a few feet of asphalt and a few years. And the answer was Chechnya. And at the time, Chechnya really meant nothing more to me than a synonym for far-flung terror and poverty. And it was only after years of reading about it, of trying to understand what this place was about, that I began writing about it, and it was because of the region's incredibly rich cultural history. It's a place that Tolstoy and Lermontov and Pushkin and Alexander Dumas all traveled to and all were inspired by. It bookends Tolstoy's entire career. He began writing his first book there as a young man, and his final book was written 50 years later, inspired by his time in Chechnya as a youth. And that's what it eventually led me to write A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, my first novel. But I'm not here to talk about that. This is my second time discussing The Tsar of Love and Techno. So I've got this sort of constellation spiel, just down solid. But we're charting new waters here. So after Constellation was published, as I was working on Constellation, every draft I would finish, I would take a month or two off, and I would work on short stories. And I wanted these short stories to be from the Russian perspective, since Constellation was sort of more invested in the Chechen side of things. And that meant that by the time I finished Constellation, I had this collection of short stories finished as well. And after my first book was published, I really began feeling like this collection didn't do it, wouldn't do justice to what I wanted to do. And so for the subsequent two and a half years or so, I spent trying to figure out how I could take these nine independent stories and weave them together so that they felt so entwined and so interconnected that if you were to lose a single one, the entire edifice would collapse. And I ended up doing that through a couple of ways. The first story in the book is called The Leopard, and it's about a censor in 1930s Leningrad, and he works in this underground room airbrushing out the images of the politically disgraced. During this time period, it was considered traitorous to simply have a picture of a traitor. And so if you were a political dissenter of some kind, if you were considered an enemy of the people, not only might you lose your life, but your entire existence might very well be obliterated from history. Kids were given inkwells in school, and they would blot out the faces of politically disgraced individuals who had been uncovered as traitorous in the time it took from their textbooks to be printed to hit their desks. And so you had these children who were learning how to censor at the exact same moment that they were learning how to write. So the erasure and the creation were closely entwined. We tend to think of the airbrush as being this this quintessentially modern tool of photographic manipulation, but it has this whole history in the Soviet Union where artists would airbrush out the faces of political enemies. Anyway, so this portrait artist Roman Markin is one of these censors who has trained as a portrait artist, trained to capture the human essence in a portrait, and instead he's tasked with erasing these faces. He is asked to airbrush out his own brother after his brother's arrest, and eventually it leads him to insert small little images, sort of postage stamp-sized images of his brother within every portrait that he has to censor. And so there are these thousands of little images of his brother that proliferate from the censor's office that nobody is aware of. And it sort of becomes this ticking time bomb that ties the other stories together as they span about a century of Russian history. I'm going to be reading from one of the stories in which the censor's work sort of touches. It's called The Grozny Tourist Bureau. And this is a story that I've been working on for a couple of years now. It began maybe about 10 years ago when I came across this little article. It was maybe three paragraphs long, about the Kosovo Tourist Bureau. And the Kosovo Tourist Bureau was comprised of a single man who worked out of his car. And I became fascinated with this idea of, both the absurdity and the pathos of this poor guy who is trying to get people to go to Kosovo right after the war ends, and he works in his car. And so a couple of years after I saw that, I read that an actual tourist initiative had been launched in Chechnya, and its director said, and this is a direct quote, I'm not making this up, it was in The Guardian, his slogan was, Chechnya is just like Switzerland, except without all the roads. It later went from Switzerland to being the Dubai of the Caucasus, and it just sort of seemed to encapsulate the sort of absurd tragedy and very dark humor of trying to rehabilitate a region that you know was about as devastated as a place could get. And so I began working on this book, and I ended up traveling to Chechnya. And so I wanted to track down the tourist bureau. And I ended up getting a 11-day tour with the first and only tour guide in Chechnya. And it was called The Seven Wonders of Chechnya. I was the only tourist on this package tour. And my tour guide was named Elena. She was incredibly sweet and welcoming. We sort of had adventures and went all over the Republic. But one of the places we saw is this rebuilt museum that was shelled in the war. So this story sort of touches on all of that. It's about a man named Ruslan who was the director of this prestigious museum that was bombed and is later tasked with starting this tourist initiative. So I'm just going to read a couple pages from this, and then I'd be delighted to answer any questions. 3 months earlier, the interior minister told me his idea. The proposition was ludicrous, but I listened with the blank-faced complacency I had perfected throughout my 23 years as a public servant. The United Nations has named Grozny the most devastated city on earth, the minister explained between bites of moist trout. I wasn't sure of the proper response, so I gave him my lukewarm congratulations. Yes, well, always nice to receive recognition, I suppose, he said. But as you might imagine, we have a bit of an image problem. He loomed over his desk in a high-backed executive chair, while across from him I listened from an odd, leggy stool designed to make its occupants struggle to stay upright before the minister. The minister's path had first crossed mine 15 years earlier, when he had sought my advice regarding a recently painted portrait of him and his sons, and I had sought his regarding a dacha near my home village. He'd had two sons then. The first immigrated before the most recent war to attend an American pharmacology school and now worked at a very important drugstore in Muskegon, Michigan. I don't know what happened to the second, but the lack of ministerial boasting serves as a death knell. That portrait, which still hung on the far wall, depicted the minister and his sons in tall leather boots, baggy trousers, long woolen coats and sheepskin hats, heroically bestriding the carcass of a slain brown bear that bore a striking resemblance to Yeltsin. For an investment, the minister continued, most others don't agree with me, but I believe we need to attract capital unconnected to the Kremlin if we're to achieve a degree of economic autonomy, and holding the record for the world's largest ruin isn't helping. Rosneft wants to sink its veins into our oil reserves, but the Chinese will cut a better deal. Have you heard of Oleg Voronov? He's on the Rosneft board, the 14th richest man in Russia, and one of the hawks who pushed for the 94 invasion. The acquisition of Chechen oil is among his top priorities. The minister set down his silverware and began sorting through the little trout bones on his plate, reconstructing the skeleton of the fish he had consumed. If we're to entice foreign investment, he said, we need to rebrand Chechnya as the Dubai of the Caucasus. That's where you come in. You're what, the director of the Museum of Regional Art? Deputy director, sir, I said. That's right. deputy director. You did fine work sending those paintings to Moscow. A real PR coup. Even British newspapers wrote about the Tretyakov exhibit. With a small nod, I accepted the compliment for what was the lowest point of my rut-ridden career. In 1999, Russian rockets had demolished the museum, and with my staff, I'd saved what I could from the ensuing fires. Soon after, I was ordered to surrender them to the Russians. When I saw that I'd been listed as co-curator of an exhibit of the rescued Chechen paintings at Moscow's Tretyakov Gallery, I closed my lids and wondered what had happened to all the things my eyes have loved. The minister tilted the plate over the rubbish bin, and the ribs slid from the spine of the skeleton fish. "Nothing suggests stability and peace like a thriving tourism center," the minister said. "I think you'd be a perfect candidate to head the project." "With respect, sir," I said. "I did my dissertation on 19th century pastoral landscapes. I'm a scholar. This is all a bit beyond me." "I'll be honest, Ruslan," he said. For this position, we need someone with three qualifications. First, he must speak English. Second, he must know enough about the history of the region to show that Chechnya is more than a recovering war zone, that we possess a rich cultural history unsullied by violence. Third, and most important, he must be that rare government man without links to human rights abuses on either side of the conflict. "Do you meet these qualifications?" "I do, sir," I said, "but I'm still entirely unqualified to lead a tourist initiative." The minister frowned. He scanned the desk for a napkin before reaching over to wipe his oily fingers on my necktie. "According to your dossier, you've worked in hotels," he said. "When I was 16, I admitted, I was a bellhop." "Well," the minister beamed, "you clearly have experience in the hospitality industry." "In the suitcase-carrying industry, sir." "Then you accept?" he asked. I said nothing. And as is often the case with men who possess more power than wisdom, he took my silence for affirmation. "Congratulations, Ruslan," he said. "You're head of the Grozny Tourist Bureau." And so my future was decided, as it often is, entirely without my consent. Office space was a valuable commodity, given how few buildings were still standing. So I worked from my flat. I spent the first morning writing Tourist Bureau on a piece of cardboard. My penmanship had been honed by years of attempting to appear productive at the office. I taped the sign to my front door, but within 5 minutes, it had disappeared. I made a new sign, then another, but the street children who lived on the landing kept stealing them. After the fifth sign, I went to the kitchen and drank the vodka bottle the minister had sent over in celebration until I passed out in tears on the floor. So ended my first day as Tourist Bureau Chief. Over the following weeks, I designed a brochure. The central question was how to trick tourists into coming to Grozny voluntarily. For inspiration, I studied pamphlets from the tourist bureaus of other urban hellscapes: Baghdad, Pyongyang, Houston. From them, I learned to be lavishly adjectival. To treat prospective tourists as semi-literate gluttons, and to impute reports of kidnapping and terrorism to the slander of foreign provocateurs. Thrilled by my discoveries, I tucked a notebook into my shirt pocket and raced into the street. Upon seeing the empty space where an apartment building once stood, I wrote, "Wide and unobstructed skies." I watched jubilantly as a pack of feral dogs chased a man and wrote, "Unexpected encounters with natural wildlife." The city bazaar hummed with the sales of looted industrial equipment, humanitarian aid rations, and munitions suited for every occasion. Unparalleled shopping opportunities at the Grozny Bazaar. Even before I reached the first checkpoint, I had scribbled, "First-rate security." The copy wrote itself. The real challenge was finding images that substantiated it. After all, the siege had remapped the city. Debris rerouted roads through abandoned warehouses. Once I found a traffic jam on a factory floor, and what was not rerouted was raised. A photograph of the present city would send a cannonball through my verbiage-fortified illusion of a romantic paradise for heterosexual couples. But I couldn't find suitable photographs of pre-war Grozny within the destroyed archives. In the end, I forewent photographs altogether and instead used January, April, and August of the 1984 Grozny Museum of Regional Art calendar for visuals. In the three 19th-century landscapes, swallows frolic over ripening grapevines, and a shepherd minds his flocks beneath a sunset. They portray a land untouched by war or communism, and beside them, my descriptions of a picturesque Chechnya do not seem entirely inappropriate. Thanks. I'd be delighted to take any questions. I know that that usually most people come to readings because they like the previous book. So I'd be happy to talk about Constellation, about this, really anything, anything at all.
Hi, my name is Jenny Holm, and I really enjoyed Constellation and haven't had a chance to read this one yet. But I'm curious about whether you've gotten any reactions to your work from Russians or Russia, and what they've been like, and yeah, generally.
Yeah, I have. I think it's a fairly self-selecting group, you know, who would take the trouble to reach out, but it's been quite positive. Probably the most one of the more moving responses I got was from a young woman who had grown up in North Ossetia, which is borders Chechnya, and she's ethnic Russian, and she had been exposed to much of the outfall of this war and particularly Chechen terrorism that had occurred within North Ossetia. Mm-hmm. And she wrote sort of this beautiful response about how that book had helped her deal with some of that. I also not too long ago got a lovely email from a teenager in Grozny who wanted to ask my permission to illegally download the book online, which
That's
was
so sweet.
It was very sweet, yeah, very well mannered. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
I also haven't read the new book, so I have a question about Constellation, yeah. Which I loved. And one of the things I really liked about it was that the Chechen characters, you know, who are Muslim, were depicted in just like kind of normal people, like without being orientalized or exotified in any way, which is actually kind of hard to find in a lot of literature written, you know, like Western literature. So I'm wondering if that was something that you thought consciously about, or that just kind of happened because you were making the characters personable.
Yeah, that's thank you so much, and that's a terrific question. I suppose that I mean I'm not Chechen myself, and the fact that I am such a complete outsider writing about such a foreign place, it made me hyper aware, I think, of falling into any kind of cliche or stereotype, and the way that I was able to reason how I was going to write that book was that I wasn't, you know, it's not, and I've never claimed that it was in any way representative of the Chechen experience in this war, but rather was representative of about a dozen characters, and really just focusing on building them up as, you know, complex individuals who weren't necessarily slotted into some sort of prefabricated group of ideals was part of it, but also Chechnya is until the 90s really was fairly secular. The influx of Wahhabism and of radical Islam was the result of these of this of the first war in the 90s, not the cause of it. And so for these characters who were all, you know, adults in the 90s, their lack of familiarity with certain certain aspects of Islam felt totally natural.
Hi. I too have I've read both books now, and I enjoyed them immensely. The question I have is, earlier in your comments, you talked about 19th century Russian literature. And several weeks ago in the New York Times, rather, David Brooks had an article about depth of soul. And he talked about depth of soul in Russia, and particularly talked about it in terms of 19th century Russian literature, and also talked about it as being dead under Putin. So that Russia has also now lost this depth of soul. He said that the United States never did have a depth of soul, so we had nothing to lose in the process. But it seems to me, and Amitav Ghosh was here with his book just a little while ago, the conclusion of his trilogy, and he talked about, in the United States at colleges, there's no discussion on campuses about these issues that were everyday discussions in India, the depth of soul issues, the universe, the moral questions, the philosophy of life. It just doesn't happen as he saw it in the Western world. So the question I have for you is, since I think your novels do have depth of soul, how do you feel about the issue in relationship to literature as you know it in the Western world, and the issue of depth of soul, and whether you see from your time in Russia, whether you see any light in there in with the notion of, are we addressing issues that we've addressed in the past, but in the computer world and in the instant seconds of everything, are no one gets into anymore?
Thank you. That's a big question. I think, sort of as I mentioned earlier, I think that what attracts so many of us to these Russian novels is that the idea of the Russian soul, I think, is maybe a little bit of a caricature by now. But those 19th century books do address these questions in ways that that I'm not sure we see in any literature today. And I think part of it may have less to do with Twitter and iPhone, just purely in terms of talking about how books are constructed than with the film medium. If you go back and look at Dostoevsky, you can tell that he had never watched a movie, that there are these long monologues, that scenes don't have, aren't compressed in the way that fiction today generally is. We even talk, in critically, you'll talk about zooming into a character. We borrow all of the language from filmmaking, and I think that perhaps one of the reasons we respond so fiercely to those wonderful Russian books of the 19th century is that they're capacious in this way, that perhaps our contemporary sense of narrative may not allow for.
You do a lot of background research to write your books, and you write fiction, which you're excellent at. But I'm curious, are you ever planning to do a non-fictional work based on the work you're doing?
Great question. No, I don't think so, because I can't make anything up that in nonfiction. I'm really in awe of there's this wonderful new biography out called The New Tsar, and it's a biography of Putin. I can't remember the name of the author, but I'm sure it's back there somewhere. The incredible amount of research the author did, and every single sentence is footnoted. I'm sort of in awe of people who can do that. I feel like I'm not, and probably won't be one of them, which is why fiction feels like a more fertile medium for me to work in. Thanks.
Hi.
Hi.
In the book Constellation, I was impressed with the struggle between competence and soul. And I felt that as a theme throughout, the most competent people often lacked soul, and the most incompetent had the greatest soul. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts on that, because I've been assaulted one time saying, well, you're not really very competent anymore. I said, I know, I traded incompetence for wisdom. But I really think what you were talking about was this balance between competence and soul. And I just wonder if you could elaborate on that just a little bit.
Thank you. As a thoroughly incompetent person, I take that as a great compliment. I think it was sort of for me with writing, everything comes from the characters at hand. So that was beautifully put, and to be entirely accurate. But to be honest, I never heard it quite phrased that way, and I'm going to steal it if it's okay with you. With those themes or that particular conflict grew out of Sonia and Ahmed. For anybody who hasn't read it, Sonia is a surgeon who's incredibly competent, but a bit hardened to the very suffering that she treats. Whereas Ahmed is a horrendous doctor, but a pretty good guy all in all. And it's funny you brought it up like that, because in the very first draft of Constellation, Ahmed was highly competent, and he was sort of like George Clooney from ER. When I went back through that first draft, I realized, you know, this sort of heroic Ahmed. You know, I realized that we may feel a lot of things for George Clooney, but sympathy, compassion, empathy, probably not wouldn't be high on the list. And it was after sort of sorting through that I began rethinking his character and presenting him instead as this, you know, a bit of a bumpkin who is tremendously well-intentioned but just can't seem to apply himself, or just can't seem to get it right. And all of a sudden, the chemistry between him and Sonia just really ignited, having this competent and this incompetent, this sort of calloused and this very open-hearted character. They each sort of challenged and brought out the best and worst in each other. And so it all, I think those ideas came from trying to create the most interesting dramatic situation for those particular characters.
Hi.
How
are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. So I loved both books. What I thought was so spectacular about the second book was really how diverse all the characters were. And to me, what really drew me in were the personalities of some of the younger characters. And I definitely saw a link between, I would say, Alexei and Sergei. And I would just love to hear your thoughts on sort of where you found those core components of these young, you know, young men in this struggle, and sort of how you were able to draw them out and bring those into the overarching story.
Thank you so much. With this book, I sort of had two goals in mind, and one was I wanted to create what was essentially a novel but told in short stories rather than chapters, and the other one was that I wanted to try to more or less write a comedy about a tragic situation, and so the process of weaving these various stories together was how I sort of tackled this novel and stories idea. For Alexei and Sergei particularly, they're probably two of the more autobiographical characters that I've ever written. I'm hanging out with my girlfriend, and whenever I say something that really makes her laugh, I'll say, "Hold on a minute, let me write that down." Which makes me insufferable. So most of the good one-liners from that were probably from that. And both of those two characters, really, I tried to sort of imprint with my own neuroses particular warped way of looking at life, I suppose. But I did want to, Constellation is told in this very very omniscient voice, you know, told from a narrator who can see into the future, who can give the history of every object in a room, this sort of very unfashionable, godlike narrator. And so for this book, I really wanted to try to tell it from the opposite end of the spectrum and use like very voicey, colloquial narrators. And Alexei and Sergei are two of my favorite in that regard.
Thanks.
Yeah, just have one more. So I've read both books and immensely enjoyed them both.
Thank you.
I had my first daughter right around the time I picked up Constellation.
Oh, wow.
And so winding up with an immense spinning joy is still one of my just favorite phrases that I repeat to myself when I pick her up in the morning.
Breaking my heart.
The question I had has sort of been, you've at least kind of tangentially addressed it in the last couple of answers, but I would just be kind of interested in hearing your thoughts on humor in literature. So many of the books that I read growing up, so many of the books that I've read since then are very serious literature, whether, you know, intentionally or not. But what set your books apart for me is just the humor from the first page. You've taken a lot of very funny shots at Boris Yeltsin as a chess piece or a bear. And so it just,
You're right. I had never even thought of that.
So anyway, I'd just be interested to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. And congratulations on the birth of your daughter. I'm pleased to hear of that coincidence. I think that books that aren't funny are difficult for me to read, I suppose, and difficult for me to write. I think that that we tend to expect serious literature to be very somber and grim and not any fun, and I don't really think that that's at all reflective of what life is like. That, you know, people make jokes at funerals and tragedies occur at birthday parties. And for me, moving between sort of the comic and the tragic, I feel like it's a way of it's almost like I joined a gym for the first time a couple months ago, and so I started like looking up, you know, what do you do when you're at a gym, and and one of the things they suggested was that you always want to switch up and do different things because your body reacts differently to different, you know, that we are as human animals very we are accustomed to falling into habits and what have you. And I think the same is true in literature, that you want to keep the reader somewhat off balance, that if you're not expecting what the next emotional turn will be, it becomes even more powerful, I think. And I think for the purposes of constructing drama, humor is one of the most important tools in the writerly toolbox, because it creates, I think, a kind of empathy. It binds us to a character. When we can laugh along with a character, we open ourselves up to that person in a way that I don't think anything else can quite replicate. And so if we've laughed with a character when the other shoe drops, I think we feel it all the more intensely and all the more sort of personally. And so that's sort of a bit of why I think that humor is essential, but particularly with this very subject matter, that there are, you know, both in Chechnya and Russia, there is this incredible streak of very dark humor, and it becomes a way of dealing with these incredibly difficult situations. You know, I think that humor we tend to conjoin it with the idea of lightheartedness, when really I think it can be conjoined with, you know, incredibly oppressive, difficult situations just as well. That a joke can be a deadly serious thing. It can be the thing, you know, that saves you from saves your soul from a particular situation, the ability to laugh at it. I remember about a year and a half ago, I met a Chechen refugee who was living in Massachusetts, and he had been tortured by Russian forces in sort of unbelievably cruel ways. and we were sitting on a he was sitting on a couch with his wife, and he was telling me about all this, and he had this big smile on his face, and he was cracking jokes while he was describing this, you know, brutal experience, and his wife was crying and was like, why? She asked him, why are you laughing about this? And he said that it was the only way he could understand it. And so I think in many ways humor is the way that these characters try to understand their own struggles. Okay.
Hi. I loved Constellation, and I'm eager to read this book.
Thank you.
And you explained, and this may relate to your answer to the question we just asked, you explained how this book sort of emerged as you were writing Constellation.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Chechnya and you have Russia. What's next?
Oh, good question. Another one that my relatives are I've sort of feel like I've taken as much from the well as I can in terms of Russia and Chechnya. I sort of see these two books as almost being of a piece. There's even sort of slight intersections between this book and Constellation, and I kind of feel like I did what I wanted to do in terms of that. So my next book is going to be set in Los Angeles and in Lipari, which is an island off of the coast of Sicily in the 30s and 40s, and it's sort of going to be a bit about the rise of monster movies in Hollywood and the rise of the mafia, stuff of that sort. I want to do something that's a bit of a change of pace. So there
sounds
you have
great.
It. Thank you.
Thank you. We invite you to hang around and get a book signed. And
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.